Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about long-term care, but we're going to really zero in on care coordination. And we have on the phone Mary Lou McGinnis, Director of Care Coordination for Long-Term Care Partners. Good morning, Mary Lou.
Morning.
Hi. And Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, know all things federal. I could almost put this on a tape. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob, and good morning, Mary Lou. How are you doing today?
Good morning, Tammy. I'm good, thanks.
Good to hear from you, and good to have you with us. We're really excited to learn a little bit more about kind of the back end of the long-term care program with some of the questions that we want to ask you about actually using the program. So that'll be interesting once we get into that.
Very good.
All righty. So my job is to ask the questions because I don't understand much about what y'all do. And I know Tammy does, and I know you do. But why does somebody buy long-term care insurance in the first place?
Well, that's a really great question to start us off with. It's a common misconception that Medicare or your health insurance is going to be there to take care of you for your long-term care needs. However, the reality is that Medicare and FEHB or your health insurance policies cover skilled medical care, while long-term care involves taking care of those everyday activities that you have to perform to get through the day. We call this custodial care. For instance, let me give you an example. You get up in the morning by transferring yourself out of bed. You bathe in the shower and then dress yourself to go to work. You probably eat your breakfast by putting toast into your mouth. Then you run into the bathroom before you leave for work to use the toilet. We often, very commonly, take these things for granted because they occur so automatically. But when you lose the ability to perform those activities of daily living because, for instance, you might have had a stroke or you become a danger to yourself or others because of a cognitive impairment, you need to get extra help to accomplish each of those tasks. We all know, in fact, that we're living longer these days, but sadly, we're not necessarily all living better, since with that advancing age that science now allows us, it often brings additional physical limitations. So without long-term care insurance, you're left to depend on families or friends to get through each day. Or you divert retirement income or assets to pay for help because this type of custodial care is not covered by Medicare or your health policies. Now, Medicare and health insurance does have a short-term rehabilitative benefit that often occurs in a nursing home setting. But sadly, this sometimes confuses people even more because they know Medicare has paid for some of their care.
Right. Mary Lou, I wanted to stop you just for 1 second because I think that's where a lot of people do get confused because we throw out the terms Medicare and Medicaid and long-term care and sometimes even disability insurance. And I think people do get confused between what are the purposes of these different programs that provide for, a lot of times do provide for care for older people who need that type of personal care or custodial care. So Medicare and Medicaid can take a small part in that, but they don't provide everything, right?
Exactly. And we're really talking about two separate programs. Medicare is of course the program that you get, that you qualify for after you become 65 years of age or you've been disabled for 2 years or more. Medicaid is you must be eligible based on income. So in order to qualify for Medicaid, you actually have to spend down those benefits that you, those assets that you have. Most states right around the $2,500 level. So you really are indigent by the time you apply and qualify for Medicaid.
Why do so many people associate Medicaid with long-term care, do you think?
Well,
I'm sorry, because I know Medicaid is where I get a lot of questions where people think that covers nursing home care. Does it?
Well, Medicare, as I say, is the policy that you would have when you become 65 years of age. Medicaid is the income eligible program, and Medicaid actually does cover for long term care in a long term care facility. However, you have to be eligible by way of your income in order to take advantage of Medicaid. So,
which means you don't have any, right?
That's right. So that's not something that commonly is going to take care of federal employees who have, for instance, a retirement plan that they're having income come in from.
That's right.
And assets, too. I believe they can't have assets. You sometimes could have not much income, but a lot of assets.
That's correct.
But if you don't have, you have to have no assets and no income.
Right. That's correct.
With so many people, saving so much money in their thrift savings plan accounts, that's also a countable asset for Medicaid. So I think the idea of having long-term care insurance is probably different for today's generation than it was even for, let's say, our parents' generation, who maybe didn't save $500,000 for their retirement, and their company pensions and their Social Security benefits didn't even cover half the cost of their long-term care needs. So I think this is something that's more relevant to our generation of pre-retirees today than it was ever before.
I totally agree with that. We're seeing more and more of that sort of instance coming up. Absolutely.
I have a question. Do you have a feel for when your sweet spot is when somebody gets the message, gee, I need this? I'm just going to be, from my own eyes, in the 40s and 50s of age. Who needs this? Because I'm going to live till forever, and I'm not going to have any issues. And with all due respect, I'm not so sure I'm different than a lot of people in that mindset. And then being around Tammy, being around you a little bit, but more so with the other folks up there, Joan, Tom, Mary Beth, Paul. And one day the light bulb goes off about a year ago, and I go, I think I need this. So how do you get the message out earlier than somebody like me that waited probably too long?
Well, from the care coordination standpoint, I can tell you, Mike, that absolutely it usually happens after someone has had an experience in needing the long-term care that comes out. For instance, a relative may have suffered a stroke, your mom or your dad or even an aunt or an uncle, and suddenly you realize that the family is struggling to get those daily needs met, that the Medicare doesn't cover it, that the health insurance doesn't cover it, that they're too wealthy to take advantage of Medicaid, and they see the family really putting themselves out there to help the person get those needs met, which often means going day to day with different family members coming in. So I would say that by far people have that light go on after they've actually seen had the experience of someone requiring long-term care. When you come down to looking at age, long-term care insurance cost is based on the age that you acquire when you go into the policy. So certainly it's less expensive when you're more like 50 than if you were to try to come into the policy when you're 70. The premiums are significantly higher at a later age. So I usually say to people, you need to start thinking seriously about it when you're 50 years old, which doesn't cover things like diving off a rock and hitting your head and being, a paraplegic because of that accident. It doesn't cover those sorts of things, but it does kind of hit that point, that hot spot, as you mentioned, where they need to start thinking of age-related issues coming up requiring that kind of care.
And also, not only does your age influence the premiums, but as you get older, if you do start to have medical issues, wouldn't those maybe prevent you from getting long-term care insurance? Because even in the federal plan, there's what's called underwriting, right?
Correct. That's correct. And though many conditions are allowed, can be underwritten successfully, the more chronic conditions you have, the more apt you are to have one of those situations that is not insurable. So certainly the underwriting would be impacted if you waited too long and had some of those things develop.
Mary Lou, do you know anything about the differences between the underwriting for life insurance versus long-term care? Because I think a lot of people think that they're one and the same, but I think you're looking at two different things, right? Because with life insurance, the company might be looking at how quickly you're going to die. And then with long-term care insurance, the underwriting might be more concerned with how long you might live. Is that right?
That's correct, and it's a good way to put it. Both of those types of insurance are based on actuarial projections, and as you say, the life insurance is basically how long are you going to how long before you're going to die. But long-term care insurance is based on taking care of those activities of daily living, and when that's the case, the longer you live, the more of that long-term care insurance you're going to require to pay for that care. So it really is two different things.
I was talking with one of your colleagues not long ago, and they expressed it in a language I could understand. I'm an accountant. In a language I really thought was, it's transferring the risk. The insurance premium is really transferring the risk of having the individual or the family to pay for this to the insurance company. And for probably not a lot of money over a number of years, if the policyholder, quote, wins and unfortunately needs long-term care, then they really transferred a lot of the burden to somebody else other than their personal assets or their family's personal assets.
Correct.
It's like
Correct.
With any insurance, I guess you have to think of it that way, that the reason why we buy insurance, whether it's car insurance or homeowners insurance or even health insurance, is that we don't have the money to cover a catastrophic expense that might come up as a result of needing that type of coverage. So I guess long-term care could also result in a catastrophic financial event, and I think also a catastrophic personal event for the family member who becomes the caregiver.
Correct. And often that caregiver is the spouse. And if you're thinking about an elderly person requiring long-term care, most often that spouse is also elderly. Mm-hmm. And most often that spouse is the female, because the men tend to get chronic conditions and tend to die sooner. So oftentimes it's the spouse, the female spouse is taking care of them right till the time they die. Then when the male spouse dies, the female is left alone without that support person there to take care of them. So long-term care really becomes important for them at that time.
Mary Lou, I've got a real-life situation for you that I thought this might be a good one to kind of walk through how you would use this type of insurance. Yesterday, a friend of mine, his father fell. He's 83 years old. He fell off a ladder trying to power wash his house and ended up in the emergency room and now is going to be hospitalized with broken bones, a broken back, and he's going to need a long time care. He may not ever fully recover, you know, due to his age. So his wife, his elderly wife, still lives in the home and his children live nearby. So if this man comes out of the hospital intensive care situation, he's going to need a lot of therapy. He's going to need a lot of rehabilitation. What would be the trigger if he had long-term care insurance? When would be the time that would come into play in a situation like that?
Well, first of all, the eligibility itself, or being eligible for the benefit, would probably be set at the date the accident occurred. Being in an acute care hospital would not be covered by long-term care insurance because the medical insurance would cover that piece of it. However, once they come out of the hospital, the acute hospital, generally they're going to go into a rehab setting of some sort. Mm-hmm. It could be either acute rehab or long-term care rehab. And the long-term care rehab for an elderly person is most common because they can't sustain the number of hours of rehab a day that the acute rehab would result in. So they'll go to a nursing home, and the date that they go into the nursing home is when their qualification period or waiting period would begin. And then as soon as their waiting period had been met, whether it was 30 or 90 days, long-term care insurance would start paying up to their daily benefit for the costs of that facility for as long as they're in it. Oftentimes, people will go from the rehab section of a long-term care facility, and maybe if they're not ready to go home yet, then would start getting actual custodial care versus skilled care. If they're getting just skilled care, Medicare often will come in and pay for a portion of that. You would still be meeting your waiting period, but Medicare would be starting to pay. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that even with Medicare paying after 20 days, there's a large deductible and copays that people have to pick up, and I'm talking several hundred dollars a day, even with Medicare covering after day 20. So the long-term care care insurance will be handy as soon as Medicare cuts out, and the long-term care insurance will be paying the bill.
And just as a frame of reference, in this part where we live here in a Washington, D.C., or probably not too different, probably any big city, the cost of that kind of care, I've found from people I know who receive it, has run anywhere from $300 to $500 a day.
Correct.
So the copay can be more than several hundred dollars.
Well, the copay and the deductibles are based on Medicare, so they actually set that rate each year, and it gets revised each year, but it is several hundred dollars. That's correct.
And then after 100 days, they stop paying, correct?
That's correct, even if you're not able to take care of yourself at that point. And actually, Medicare usually stops well before the 100 days. They stop whenever progress stops.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of rehab, if you're not walking another foot a day, you're not making progress according to Medicare. So Medicare will then discontinue the payment, and that's when your long-term care insurance would have to pick up, or your private resources, whatever those might be, would have to pick up.
Right. If you haven't met your waiting period yet, then you just pay out of pocket until, let's say, the 90 days were up or the 30 days were up.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
I believe with the long-term care partners, the policy, you get to choose a benefit period, and it's 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, or unlimited. Do you have any kind of feel for if this malady unfortunately hits somebody, say at 60, what the length of period of time that they might be under care, the person that would be subject to that, or somebody at 65, does it last 5 years, Dan? Does it last unlimited? So in other words, somebody looking at this might say, well, the younger I am, I might want the unlimited because I don't know if this will hit me at 60.
Right.
If it hits me at 70, I don't know that I want unlimited. I might want 5 years. And that's one question. And the second question is, if I choose unlimited, can I back down and go to five as I age?
All good questions, Mike. And I think it's like anything else in life. You kind of play the odds. And if you do that, studies show that the average long-term care claim lasts 2.6, to be specific, years. So when you're deciding on the length of your policy, you need to keep that in mind. As we all know, long-term care insurance can be very expensive, so you have to look at your options as to what your pocketbook can bear, as well as what your wishes are. An unlimited policy is very costly, so with claims lasting only 2.6 years on average, it makes an unlimited policy pretty unlikely that it's going to be necessary. We usually suggest people think about those two things, what their wishes are and what their pocketbook will be able to afford. Our most common or popular plans tend to be the 3 or 5 year plans, not the unlimited. We have a relatively small number that go with unlimited. So playing the odds, I think you're pretty safe with getting a 3 or 5 year policy, and that's something that probably you're going to be able to afford better as well.
But as Bob was saying, could you downgrade the policy as you get older and you decide that maybe it's either not as affordable or you just don't feel like you need as much coverage? So if you bought the unlimited, could you reduce the coverage to, let's say, 5 or 3 years down the road?
Absolutely. You can always reduce at any time, regardless of your circumstances. If you were to decide you wanted to go the other direction and go from a 3-year plan to unlimited, then you would have to go through underwriting again in order to make sure that you didn't have some adverse situation going on which made you want to increase the policy at that time. So if you're going up and getting more benefit, then you would have to undergo underwriting. You can always go down, though.
Mm-hmm. Mary Lou, I know your background is in the healthcare field. In fact, you're a nurse, correct?
That's correct.
And why would long-term care partners need a nurse? What is that role of a nurse working for long-term care partners?
Actually, it's probably a rarity among long-term care insurance companies that we set it up this way, but this is something that the Office of Personnel Management, or OPM, who is the sponsor of this program, insisted from the beginning. They wanted to have registered nurses that acted as both the director for this department as well as actually the care coordinators or case managers of each individual claim. They wanted that medical input into it. I think that nurses are able to very simply use nursing judgment when it comes to some of these things. In other words, a diagnosis isn't everything. And in fact, in long-term care, it often doesn't mean a whole lot to us. It's more being able to listen to the person's needs, send out an assessor to the home to see how they're able to function, and then using that nursing judgment to decide, even though they may not have a serious diagnosis, this is a person whose activities of daily living really do need that kind of assistance that we provide.
So in the example I gave you with the man falling off the ladder, would it be his family who would be calling you and talking to you about using that policy to help, you know, get him set up for benefits?
Well, that's a really good point, and something that I always kind of get on a soapbox about, and that is that you need to always be aware of the things you have to have on file in order to make those decisions at a time when you might not be able to make the decisions for yourself. The only person who can actually open a claim for somebody is either the person themselves or the person who has the legal responsibilities for acting on that person's behalf, such as a durable power of attorney.
Wow.
So it's sometimes very sad because people of the older generation are so used to speaking for their spouse, they think they can do that. But, of course, HIPAA requirements are so different now than they used to be. We really have to go by that legal representative. So their family can help the spouse get started with things, or they can call and tell us that there is that this need is going on, and we do the very best we can to try to make contact with somebody that has the legal authority to speak for that person.
What you said is really important, I think, because it sounds like long-term care insurance goes hand in hand with having those estate planning documents that we always talk about, such as the durable power of attorney. And without that, you could really be at a struggle trying to use that policy if you weren't able to speak for yourself.
Absolutely. Wow. People think they can just have the, for instance, the hospital call, the hospital discharge planner or a social worker call to do it. But we have to, because of the insurance policy is a contract, we have to be able to speak to the person that has that legal responsibility for the person or the person themselves.
This is probably a legal question, but you could have a durable power of attorney and pull the strings here. How about a health care power of attorney? Would that provide the same horsepower that a durable power of attorney would?
Well, excellent question. And the durable power of attorney, or the power of attorney for health care, or as we know it, the medical proxy sometimes, those people can make health care decisions. However, this is an insurance policy, and so it needs to be the financial durable power of attorney that calls in order to access this insurance contract.
Yeah, because it's releasing money
exactly.
to care for you. And how would, like, okay, so going back to that situation, so let's say there is a durable power of attorney, so his wife calls. How is the decision determined that he actually qualifies to use the policy? Is that his doctor who decides, or do you ask questions, or is there an independent person involved?
A lot depends on the setting that this benefit eligibility is being determined at. So for your friend's case, where they're in the hospital, we would probably get the hospital records of exactly what's going on, and those records are going to tell us what his activities of daily living are going to be going forward, or if any cognitive impairment has occurred because of a head injury maybe went during the fall.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody is at home, the very best way we can do that is by sending a registered nurse into the home to do an assessment that we have set up that will actually watch the person perform the activities of daily living. Now, obviously, we don't make somebody take a bath, but we do watch them climb into the shower so that we can see whether they're safe holding on to handrails or sitting down on a shower seat. We watch that. We watch them put on a sweater, buttoning the buttons, those kinds of things. Your doctor often doesn't know in a situation where you're at home how well you're able to perform those activities of daily living. All they know basically is what you tell them when you go into the office. So we send somebody into the home so that we can actually observe those activities of daily living. We provide a what we call a mini mental, which is a cognitive test so that we can get a baseline measurement of what their cognitive capacity is.
But that's a person that doesn't work for Long-Term Care Partners, though, right? It's a service that's out there that you contact?
We subcontract with a vendor, right, that mm-hmm. provides those services, absolutely, so that we actually do that across the nation, and we also have an international vendor that takes care of that type of assessment if somebody is located internationally.
That's a good thing to know, because a lot of long-term care policies won't sell you a policy in this country if you're going to be living overseas, but that's not the case with the federal plan, right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And we've had some interesting international cases from interior India, where we sent a doctor on a bus for 8 hours in order to go and do the assessment. So we've had some interesting international situations.
Now we know why a lot of companies don't want to deal with that, right?
Exactly.
Well, that's a good thing to know for our retirees who do want to move overseas.
And we do have a lot of, especially some of the expats, the military people that have been overseas somewhere and decide to go back there and settle after they get done military service or whatever.
Right.
With regards to the policy, you said something interesting. At least I thought it was that the average lasts 2.6 years or 2.5 years. But for those that might feel that, okay, that's an average, but they might be more susceptible to a longer term payout. You got to be concerned with inflation, I would imagine, if it's going to be longer term. And I believe you all, as well as others, provide for an inflation rider. And I think you can pick between 4% and 5%. Correct me if I'm
wrong. No, you're absolutely correct.
And so do you find that many people take that, or do they just not understand? I mean, 4 or 5% inflation for many people today, we've been spoiled with, you know, very low inflation. So we say, why would I need that? Because inflation is, what, 1, 1.5, 2%. But remember, this is for long term, and I'm not so sure long term inflation is.
Plus, healthcare costs go up differently than regular costs.
Yeah.
Right. No, those are good points, and it goes back to that. How do we make a policy available to somebody that fits not only their needs but their financial abilities? Choosing the inflation factor that will adequately cover the current rate of inflation is important, but that as opposed to maybe getting the most expensive inflation option available to you. If you get a 5% automatic compound inflation, it certainly will more than cover what the inflation rate is today and for the foreseeable future. However, it's also very, very expensive. So when we came out with the second version of the policy, we actually put in a 4% as well so that you can save some money by choosing the 4%. We also have an option called future purchase option, where instead of paying at an elevated rate all the time for the automatic compound inflation, you are asked every 2 years if you would like to increase the benefits that you have. And if that's the case, if you say yes, then you pay a little bit more at that point going forward. And every 2 years you're asked, you can say no at any time if you decide you don't want to go higher. But that rate is paid only when you take the increase, as opposed to the automatic compound inflation, which is paid throughout.
With the future purchase option, do you have any sense as to when that catches up to if you would have just bought the automatic in the first place? Or like, when is it best to choose that option?
There is a cutoff point that I have seen a graph on, but I'm afraid I can't address that for you, Tammy. But yes,
yeah, that'd be something to look at, I think, if you were considering that option, especially at a young age, because you might find that in the long run it might be better just to do the automatic inflation if you're going to be paying premiums for 30 years.
Well, for that reason and some of the other things that we've talked about today, showing all the number of options you have available, it's always a good idea to be able to talk with a representative who can explain each of the choices to you along with the associated costs with that option. And so we have program consultants available at the 1-800-LTC-FEDS number. And if you prefer to use the web, you can visit the premium calculator, which again will show you the difference in what these options cost. You can find that online at ltcfeds.com.
Yeah, there's a lot of information there for sure. Going back to the gentleman that I used for that example, let's say that for 90 days he's getting care in this rehab facility and he's making progress, but you know Medicare is about ready to cut him off. And at that point, you've already got him on the list that he can't perform those activities of daily living. So he's counting down his waiting period, right?
Correct.
Now, what
Correct.
If he does recover enough that he no longer needs that care, he becomes independent again? Would that count towards a future time when he might need care a second time?
Absolutely. And it's important to know that that elimination period or waiting period, whatever you want to call it, it only has to be met once in your lifetime. So once you have met what you have in your policy as the waiting period, when you come back into claim, you do not have to meet that again. But that brings up another important point, and that is that people assume once they come into claim that they're going to be in claim for the rest of their lives. And we actually have about 18% of our claimants that recover from claim. That means they no longer need the level of assistance that they did when they first became benefit eligible. So it's important to know that like any insurance, you know, you have to continually be meeting the requirements of the policy in order to have that policy be paying for your care.
How often is that check made, like, for instance, you know, to come out to see if the person is still needing care, or is it up to the individual to notify you?
No, we take care of that. We have to do it at a minimum of once per year. Mm-hmm. But if it's somebody, not your friend, because mm-hmm. that was a major accident, right. But if, say, someone fractured their hip, mm-hmm. An elderly person who was healthy beforehand fractured their hip, we might check back with them and do an assessment again in 6 months, because oftentimes things like that, if you go into it in a healthy situation, they improve over time. So we do, again, use that nursing judgment as to what the prognosis for this type of injury or illness might be.
We got an email knowing that you were coming on, and I think this person, they're a frequent emailer, is shopping. And I know we're talking to federal long-term care partners, and we've been fairly generic but specific as well. But let's be a little bit specific with this. I don't want to put you on the spot here, but how often does long-term care partners deny somebody? I shouldn't say how often, but coverage. You have the ability to do that, and the non-long-term care feds, I think they're pretty tough as far as accepting or denying people. So let's just talk about you.
Okay.
Rather than them.
Well, it's actually a kind of a combined discussion, Mike, because most long-term care insurance companies do use the same criteria, and that is that you need to have require assistance with at least two of the activities of daily living. So those things that I mentioned before, the bathing, dressing, eating, transferring, toileting, continence, you need to require assistance with at least two of those. Or you need to have a significant cognitive impairment. And when one of those two things exists, either the two activities of daily living or the cognitive impairment, almost any long-term care insurance company is going to approve you. Now, we measure both the denial rates for benefit eligibility and for the actual payment of a claim invoice that comes in for us. And we're very proud of the fact that the combined rate for those two things is 2.1%. Obviously, benefit eligibility is a little higher because there are fewer of those than the invoices coming in. However, the reality is that many times people are denied benefit eligibility only for that period of time, and when their condition requires more assistance, they're going to come into claim later on. So it's not that you're saying this condition doesn't make you benefit eligible. What you're saying is this condition right now isn't making you benefit eligible, but in six months that may change.
And when you use the word assistance with dressing and bathing and feeding, that doesn't mean that you can't do it yourself. It just means you need someone to help you. Is that right?
That's correct. You need assistance in order to accomplish that. Now, activities of daily living are defined differently by different people. For instance, a doctor may write a note for you saying, well, they need assistance with eating. Mm-hmm. And what they really mean is that they can't grocery shop for themselves and they can't cook their meals. But we have definitions for each of these activities that we have to follow. And eating actually means putting food into your mouth or drinking out of a cup. That's what eating means. Mm-hmm. Bathing can mean whatever your normal type of bathing is. So, for instance, if you always take a tub bath and you cannot take a tub bath anymore, then that makes you benefit eligible in bathing. Mm-hmm. But the definitions are important because we maintain a consistent criteria for how we judge whether that activity requires the level of assistance that is needed to meet the criteria.
And that one term that's used is called transferring. And I think a lot of people don't even know what that means. Could you explain the transferring activity?
Sure. Transferring would be, for instance, getting up out of bed in the morning to a standing position, or moving from, if you were in a wheelchair, moving from bed to the wheelchair, getting up off of the couch in the living room. It does not mean ambulation. So you don't have to be able to walk a mile, mm-hmm, in order to require to be free of assistance with that sort of thing.
Right.
With transferring, you just need to be able to move from one position to another position.
Without assistance, mechanical assistance or someone actually.
Well, no, actually mechanical assistance would be okay. For mm-hmm. instance, if you had to get up to a walker, mm-hmm, and you use the sides of your walker in order to help pull you up, that's okay as long as you can do it by yourself. But if you can't manage that because your arms aren't strong enough, then you would require assistance with transfer.
Okay, that's a good definition. I always wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a 60th birthday party Saturday night, and we bought a present, and it said every 6-year-old should have a walker, and we gave him Johnny Walker Scotch.
Not that kind of walker.
Anyway.
Then you'd need assistance with cognitive impairment. Oh, my gosh. So with this federal long-term care program, Mary Lou, are there any other big items that you wanted to make sure that we understand before I go back into some of the questions? Is there anything that we've missed so far?
No, actually, I thought you'd done a good job as far as pointing out some of the things that we get many, many questions about. The claim process can be a very complicating process for people to go through, only because it's coming at a time in their lives when they're probably stressed anyways, and there are a number of components that we have to go through in order to reach that benefit eligibility criteria. So we try to explain right from the first call and re-explain each time we talk to them and let them know through brochures and whatnot exactly what the process is going to entail.
Yeah, in the seminars, we talk so much about, you know, how you purchase this insurance and how you figure out what it's worth and how to buy it, but we don't talk about the other end. That's why I'm so happy to have you on the show today to talk about actually using the policy. And I think another big area that the reason why I like to have long-term care insurance is not so much if I end up in a nursing home, but if I'm at home and I need that type of care, if I need that assistance or that supervision. But how does that work if somebody's actually living in their home and they need a family member to care for them? How does that informal caregiver benefit work?
Well, and that's something that we're very proud of with this program, because we have probably the most flexible informal care benefit that any of the long-term care insurance policies have. Anyone who has a comprehensive policy, which is the option to use both facilities and home care, has the ability in our program to use an informal provider. And the informal provider is someone who works directly for our client, which means that our insured is the employer. This is both a good situation for the client as well as a responsibility, since being the employer means you are responsible for certain taxes, work safety rules, and liabilities in that role. To address this, we've actually partnered with a company called Hire Family, who specializes in helping individuals meet those responsibilities and payroll and tax issues that are involved with being an employer.
So if I hired my daughter-in-law to be my caregiver and she came over every day to help dress and bathe and all the things that I needed help with, I would actually be paying her from my policy, and then I'd also be responsible for paying employer taxes?
Correct.
Wow.
Based on the state taxes required where you are. In general, with us, any adult can be an informal provider as long as they're physically able to provide the care that our client needs and whatever is required for their activities of daily living or cognitive needs.
But it can't be your spouse, right?
It cannot be anyone that lives in your home at the time you go into claim. So if, in fact, your daughter-in-law lived in your home with you at that time, she would not be eligible. The spouse, because they're living there with you, are not eligible. But anybody else that is physically able is allowed to become the informal provider.
What if before you need the long-term care, what if you had moved in with your son and daughter-in-law and eventually then needed that type of care? Like maybe initially you didn't qualify, you just needed, you know, a little bit of help. But later down the road, as things got more significant, then you qualified. Then would you still not be able to hire the daughter-in-law since you were already living with her at that time?
Correct. It's okay. When the claim opens. So if you had tried to come into claim and you were found not benefit eligible, there would be no claim in place. When you came back again, we would back it up to whenever that eligibility was actually documented, say in your doctor's notes or whatever. But whoever was living in your home at that time when the benefit eligibility date was established, they would not be eligible to be the informal provider.
But that's a wonderful respite benefit for that caregiver, whether it's your spouse or if you're living with your children, that they can actually hire someone from outside to give them a break since they're probably on duty 24/7.
Absolutely. And it's also good for the elderly person because if you stop to think about it, having a stranger come into the home when you're there alone or they're alone with your elder spouse, it's sometimes very frightening for people. So to be able to have Mary, the daughter-in-law, come in to be the informal provider, that sometimes goes a long ways to help people feel more comfortable. Absolutely.
Sure. How is the pricing determined then? Because, you know, I want to pay my daughter-in-law $100 an hour. Could I do that?
Well, I won't say that people don't want to do that. That's probably very common. Mm-hmm. What we do is we use a national site to establish what the traditional rate of pay is in your geographic area, because obviously those of you around Washington have very high rates for any type of care. But if you're living in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, that rate is probably very different. So we go into the site, find out what the traditional rate is for a home care agency to be paying their providers in your area, and that's what we tell you is the appropriate level to establish.
Yeah, that makes sense. That seems fair.
Tammy and I were talking after last week's show about this week, and I'm not being a Fed, but I understand how Feds work, probably more on the tax and finance side, certainly than the benefits. But I was saying, well, you know, somebody becomes disabled, then they don't pay disability insurance, and they should buy this. And Tammy reminded me that a federal employee could retire under disability and receive a monthly annuity. But it isn't necessarily going to cover all the expenses, so that doesn't preclude the idea of buying long-term care insurance. In fact, it enhances it. So at least they have some income, and then this on top of it would make the financial burden that much less. I forget who said it, but it was one of your folks. I just really like you transfer the liability to the insurance company by buying this, and what a great comment.
Yeah,
correct.
What we were also talking about, Bob, was the fact that sometimes around age 50 to 60, 50, 55, and 60 is when the government life insurance benefit, the option B of the federal group life insurance, becomes very pricey. It starts to double during those 10 years. And so a lot of employees by that time in their life, their kids might be grown, the house is paid off, they don't need as much life insurance as they needed 20 years ago. So sometimes they'll take the cost of those premiums and use that to buy long-term care insurance, which now becomes more of an issue for themselves. And also it's a benefit to their children that they've raised, that they don't have to be the sole caregiver. They can hire help to if they should need that type of help. So I think it could be considered a gift to your kids.
Yeah. My comment to Tammy, I'm not a Fed, but I did have disability insurance. But after a certain age, they cut you off. And I go, what am I going to do with the premium? And my wife had some ideas. Actually, it was this. Mm-hmm. And she's the one that pushed me. And I go, I never thought of it like that.
It's a gift to your wife, too, because that's number one caregiver on the list.
Anyway.
Mary Lou, the other thing when we were talking about the informal caregiver and receiving care in the home, there's another piece of this long-term care insurance. It's called a stay-at-home benefit. What is that, and how does that work, and how would that play into using your long-term care insurance?
The stay-at-home benefit was actually a nice addition to the second version of our policy that came out in 2009. So it's available in many policies now, and certainly all policies going forward it's available in. It's a way to make your home safe and accessible so that you can receive your care there for as long as you wish. There's a number of options that come under this benefit that allow for things like home modification, maybe putting a stair lift in because you can't get up the stairs anymore, or putting a ramp in. An emergency medical response system would be covered, durable medical equipment that you might need, along with caregiver training or a home safety check to make sure your home is free from safety hazards. Many of these options are actually available in earlier FELCIT policies under the alternate plan of care provision. So they are available for the 1.0 policies as well. Mm-hmm. The goal of this, along with any long-term care insurance policy, is to allow the flexibility so that each client can access support for the type of care that is most beneficial to them. And that's what the stay-at-home benefit tries to do.
Now, if some of those things, like, for instance, durable medical equipment, were covered by Medicare, that would only be for any residual costs that you would pay out of pocket that would then go to your long-term care? Would it be a coordination of that benefit?
We actually, by law, cannot coordinate benefits with Medicare. So if Medicare is going to pay for something, they pay for it, like durable medical equipment, and then the DME companies accept what Medicare pays. Mm-hmm. But if Medicare denies it, then we would pick up the cost. That's how that works. They have to deny it before we can pick up. However, your health insurance, if your health insurance covered so much on something, mm-hmm. then we would then kick in and coordinate benefits with it.
And how does that work whenever you buy long-term care insurance? It's a daily benefit, you know, maybe $150 a day for 3 years. Would that count against that pool of money, or would that be outside of your daily benefit amount?
The stay-at-home benefit mm-hmm. is outside of the daily benefit amount. So regardless of what you were requiring for care, that stay-at-home benefit would be outside of that, so would not count against
it. So you'd still have your full time period and your daily amount to spend after that.
Correct.
Good. And I remember reading someplace, I think this is part of the same benefit, that if, let's say you did want to hire a family member to be your caregiver, but they don't know how to properly, you know, help you get into the bathtub or help you transfer. So would there be any training available that could also be paid for through your benefit?
Yes, that would be the caregiver training, and a lot of times that's as much for the safety of your caregiver as it is for you, because a lot of times it involves things like transferring someone, and you know you can hurt your back very easily by transferring and twisting in incorrectly. So we provide the nurse going into the home to actually teach the caregiver the types of care that you require so that it makes it safer for both the insured and the caregiver.
That's a good idea. Who is eligible to purchase long-term care insurance through the federal plan?
Any federal employee who is an active federal employee is eligible to get the long-term care policy at any time. Unlike some benefits, you don't have to wait for an open season in order to get it. You have to just simply contact the LTC Feds number, the 1-800-LTC-FEDS, or use ltcfeds.com, the website, and you can enroll at any time. After you become a new employee, in the 60 days right after you become employed, there's a basically an open enrollment period for you when you have abbreviated underwriting.
That means fewer health questions, right?
That's correct. Yep. That's correct. But other than that, you're eligible at any time to come into the policy. So no time like the present.
So who else besides federal employees can enroll? Can retirees enroll? And how about family members?
Absolutely. Annuitants are part of the federal family. And as well as the annuitants, we allow in what we call qualified relatives, which might be your parents, your adult children, your in-laws. So those people are all considered qualified relatives, and they actually have access to the federal policy as well.
But so, not brothers and sisters or cousins, right?
Brothers and sisters also are allowed. Cousins, no, but brothers and sisters, yes.
So how about siblings?
How about friends?
No. Sorry, Mike.
Okay, then with this, what do you call it, Tammy, when you work part-time and you're retired part-time?
Oh, when we're retorquing, as I call it, this new phased retirement that's coming for federal employees. But they'll be both retired and working, but I think either way they would be eligible to enroll.
We don't have a length of time a number of hours that you have to be working. You simply have to be considered an active employee before qualifying.
Right.
Okay, so this wouldn't affect them any. They're on both sides of the fence, but they're still full feds. They might be working half-time, and they're retired half-time.
No one's doing it yet, Mary. This is a brand new thing. You've probably not even heard about it yet.
I have not, no.
But when that does become available, we'll have to clarify that at the time, because we'll have some employees who will be partially retired and partially working, and I think a lot of employees are kind of looking forward to that option, so we'll keep you apprised when it comes about, and I'm sure OPM will get you guys up to speed on that as well when it becomes available.
Very good.
Okay, Andrew has given us the bring the plane down for a slow landing sign, so we're inside of a minute. Final comments, Mary Lou?
No, I just think that we appreciate the opportunity to present this program so that people can become informed about the flexibility that it offers. And we certainly welcome, we have over 270,000 federal employees and their qualified relatives enrolled at this time, and we certainly are able to handle lots more.
And what's that website again?
The website is ltcfeds.com. The phone number is 1-800-LTC-FEDS or 582-3337.
Great. Thanks for being on. Thanks for being so informative. Tammy, thanks for asking all the questions I couldn't.
It was fun. I was looking forward to this one. Thanks, Mary Lou.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.